Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this second compulsory acquisition hearing. My name is Rin Smith, and I'm the lead member of an examining authority appointed on the 2nd of October 2018 under Section 61 and 65 of the Planning Act of 2008 as amended, under delegation from the Secretary of State to examine an application for the Thanet offshore wind farm extension. I have made a declaration of interests responding to the Planning Inspectorate's conflict of interests policy and can confirm that I have no declarable interests in relation to this appointment. And so I will now introduce my fellow panel members who were appointed on the same date.
Good morning, my name is Jessica Powis and I can confirm that I also have no declarable interests in relation to my appointment on this panel.
Thank you very much, Ms. Powis. And to my left.
My name is Stephen Bradley. I have made a declaration of interest that until August last year, I was a volunteer writer for the Thames Estuary Partnership, and since appointment to this panel, I ceased further involvement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bradley. Now, introducing briefly additional staff here from the Planning Inspectorate supporting us today. To my far right, Mr. Robert Ranger, who is a case manager at the Planning Inspectorate, and sitting in the rear of the public area of the room, Mr. Bart Butkowiak. Both of these gentlemen are available at any point during this morning's hearing. If anybody has a question or needs any guidance or assistance, and they seek input in relation to a matter that they don't wish to bring out necessarily formally in the public forum. So do feel free to contact either of them at any point if you need to. We are, as I have indicated, examining an application for development consent for the Thanet Offshore Wind Farm Extension, a nationally significant infrastructure project made by Vattenfall Limited, who we will refer to in this meeting as the applicant. And I take it that everybody in the room is now sufficiently familiar with the application such that there is no need to recite any of its content or purpose in detail. If I can then direct you to Annex C of the Examining Authority's letter of the 9th of April 2019, which contains an agenda for this hearing, which very usefully is now being placed on all of the screens in the room. Does anybody need but not have a hard copy of this agenda, as we do have some spares? No, that's excellent news. The entire focus of this morning's hearing is compulsory acquisition, and you'll be conscious that we have already held one compulsory acquisition hearing where we have essentially inquired into the strategic case made by the applicant for the compulsory acquisition powers that it seeks to include in the development consent order. And so the primary purpose today is to inquire into and provide an opportunity to be heard for individual affected persons who object to compulsory acquisition, temporary possession, or related powers sought by the applicant in the draft development consent order. The purposes of the hearing more broadly were set out in the agenda. Does anybody have any in principle questions about the nature of the exercise that we're involved with today? Indeed, that is also good news. Now, given that you have been introduced to us, I think it's now important that we find out who is here. And so we actually complete an introductory process by passing around the tables. And I will, as is customary, I'll start to my right-hand side. I'll pass through affected persons and their representatives here. And I will finish by asking the applicant to introduce their team. So, sir, from my right.
Good morning, sir. Yes, Gary Churchill, Estate Manager for the National Trust.
Thank you very much. Mr. Churchill, can I just ask you to slightly tilt your table around and perhaps move a couple of bottles, because I'm afraid I cannot see that table around, and it is important that I do continually remind myself of who is speaking for whom. Thank you very much. Now, moving on to, I take it, representatives for Ramac Holdings Limited.
Good morning. My name is Robert Thorogood from Hurley Palmer Flat, acting on behalf of Ramac Holdings.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Isabella Taffour, and I'm a barrister representing Ramac.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, sir. David Haynes, partner Charles Russell Speechley's, solicitors for Ramac.
Thank you.
Good, Good morning, sir. It's John Parry from Glenny Surveyors, representing Raymac Holdings Limited.
Okay. Now, what I'm actually going to suggest the Raymac representation do, given that there are four of you, and we have more than an adequate number of microphones in the room, is if you can borrow unused microphones from further down the table, each of you will be able to have a microphone, and we will get a much better recording as a consequence. Madam.
Good morning. My name is Magdalena Gepka-Scuffins, and I'm here on behalf of Crossline Limited.
Thank you very much. Now, if I can run to the applicant.
Good morning, sir. My name is Jonathan Bauer from Womble Bond Dickinson, representing the applicant.
Thank you.
Good morning, sir. My name is Jennifer Holgate from Womble Bond Dickinson, also on behalf of the applicant.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Delilah Ben-Shabain, project design lead for Vattenfall for the applicants.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm John Hillis, surveyor from Blackhall and Powys for the applicant.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. I'm Mike Gettenby, senior legal counsel and in-house lawyer for the applicant.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Sean Leake, Gobi Consultants, EIA lead for the applicant. And for those of you familiar with previous hearings, I shall also be Sammy Mullen in charge of digital projections for the day.
Well, thank you very much for multitasking. It is important to note that we are distinctly grateful to those who manage that process, because I think one of the distinguishing marks of this examination throughout has been the utterly seamless and extraordinarily useful way in which documentation has been immediately available. On request, and so you are subject to an extraordinarily high standard test.
Could I just also say we have Nick Dexter from Ardent behind, but we've run out of table space and microphones. So if he is required later, then
you will call him forward. I'm sure. Yes, thank you very much for that introduction. Speaking of microphones, of course, those of you who have participated before are more than aware now that we do digitally record everything that transpires at these hearings, and it is our policy that the digital record is retained and published on our website for a minimum of 5 years after the Secretary of State's decision, and therefore if you participate and place matters orally on the record, we take it therefore that you consent to the retention and publication of the digital record for those purposes. Are there any other matters of a preliminary or a procedural nature, ladies and gentlemen, that need to be raised now before we move into the agenda? I will highlight as well in relation to the agenda that I propose to deal with matters essentially with full flexibility, recognising that it is not the desire of affected persons to be here for a second longer than they need to be. So what I'm proposing then to do is to move with no further ado to agenda item two. But what I thought I would highlight is that if there are any elements of agenda item three that any of the affected persons wish to speak to, what I will ask you to do is to wrap that into your primary submissions on agenda item two, so that once you're done and clear, you can go. You don't need to hang around for agenda order. And similarly, agenda item four is essentially an item between the examining authority and the applicant, because it's in relation to persons who are not physically here today. If there was anything that you believed needed to arise under agenda items 5 through to 7, again, I'm prepared to deal with those on an individual basis once your primary case has been put. Again, in the interests of enabling you to leave as soon as your matters have been dealt with. Is everybody clear on that point? Doesn't cause anybody a problem. Now, in terms then of the order of today, my feeling is that it would make sense if we start with the National Trust, if we then move to Raymac, and we then, as Crossline are a tenant of Raymac, we can hear Crossline having heard RAMAC, because it strikes me there is a distinct likelihood of there being an interplay between the two sets of submissions, and I also think it may be necessary to offer cross-line opportunities to essentially back comment onto RAMAC submissions and RAMAC equivalents opportunity to back comment onto cross-line. Everybody content? Good. So let's hear. Yes.
Jonathan Bauer for the applicant. Sorry, sir. In terms of the responses, I presume you'll take the responses
yes,
to each
will.
One in turn.
Yes, we Thank will. You. No, don't worry. I'm not leaving you out. And each time we conclude from an individual AP, I will then take responses from you and your team. Okay. Can we then go to the National Trust? And if I can ask you to take us to the latest position. And essentially here, you know, I remain interested, we remain interested in any progress that has been made around the negotiation of your position with the applicant. And we also remain distinctly interested in the inalienable land point, the fact that this is inalienable land over which the applicant seeks rights. Sir.
Thank you, sir. Gary Churchill, National Trust. Well, just to go over what I reported at the last hearing, the Trust objects in principle to the scheme, or to the route, and we have also made that clear. But parallel to that, I have reported to the Trust's Board of Trustees because of the threat to inalienable land, which is our policy and our duty to do so. And they have given me authority, parallel with this operation, to negotiate with Vattenfall's agents to look at a negotiated settlement for an easement across the routes. We would only agree that if the terms were reasonably appropriate for the Trust, and on the basis that the CPO would be withdrawn over the Trust's inalienable land. As far as progress is concerned, we have appointed a valuer to act for us locally, and we've also appointed a solicitor specialising in this sort of matter. As things stand at the moment, we have received the draft option agreement and a draft deed, which we're going through, but we haven't actually made any progress on a negotiation of compensation or mitigation. Mm. Thank you.
Now, in terms of progress, and the inalienable land point, I mean, it is our understanding that unwithdrawn objections from the National Trust in respect of inalienable land are one of the few remaining circumstances in which special parliamentary procedure may be invoked. Now, one of the things that we need to be clear about are the relevant settings that apply to the consideration of this particular piece of land when we report to the Secretary of State. So one of two positions is likely to be the case as we see it. Either there has been sufficient progress in negotiations, at least to the point of heads of terms between yourselves and the applicant, such that your in-principle objection can be withdrawn. That can be reported to the Secretary of State, and on that basis we would report to the Secretary of State that essentially the prospect of special parliamentary procedure had been withdrawn or discharged, or alternatively it would not be. Now, examining authorities, this is not to place you under any pressure to concede to matters to which you do not agree. At the end of the day, that is a private negotiation between yourselves and the applicant. However, what examining authorities in these circumstances always seek to do is to provide, if possible, the clearest frame of reference for decision making to the Secretary of State. And so, therefore, if there are circumstances where a power or where a requirement, rather, such as that for special parliamentary procedure is in place, and it is possible for that to be removed or discharged, an examining authority is normally very grateful to to have that clarified, if there are negotiations that are possible, if there is an agreement that is possible, to have that clarified before the end of the examination, so that the Secretary of State in turn can be clear about what the route forward might be. Alternatively, if the negotiations are not brought to fruition, then the examining authority must report the matter to the Secretary of State as there being still a prospect that SPP, special parliamentary procedure, might be required. Now, obviously, that can then be removed from the table by subsequent agreement up to the point of the actual decision itself. But again, I would emphasise that, you know, the decision, the reporting period and the decision-making period are in principle not times when it's sensible to be involved in the detail of negotiations, because, of course, whilst the examination is live, if there are public policy relevant matters that come out that essentially need to be adjudicated by us, then we can deal with them. But as soon as we go beyond our six-month deadline and the examination closes, those matters can no longer be examined. So I guess that's a very long-winded and rather rambling way of me saying to you that if there are any matters that you want to put before us essentially for adjudication because they are disputed between you and the applicant, and you do not see any reasonable prospect of them being resolved by the end of the examination period, then it's actually critically important that we don't end today without that possibility being flagged up, because we then need to think procedurally about how we use the remaining written deadlines, given that these are the last hearings in the process, we use the remaining written deadlines to get to a point where we can actually work out how we might resolve a matter that you might be putting in front of us for any form of adjudication. So I guess my first clear and simple question to you is, do you think there are matters that are likely to remain in dispute that you wish to bring to our table, so to speak?
So, yeah, as things stand at the moment, I don't believe so, but we are still at early stages stage one of negotiation, that we've got the drafts, but we haven't agreed terms. The only thing I would say is what I said at the last hearing. We do wonder about the extent of the proposed acquisition of interests. It's quite a broad area, and we haven't had any definite designated routes, and that would certainly be a matter that we would have to tie down with any agreement.
Well, at this stage then, unless there is more detail that you can sort of shake out onto the table, what I'm going to do is to draw your attention to the remaining deadlines in the timetable, because if there is a matter that you want us specifically to consider, essentially the absolute last opportunity for it to be put before us in writing is deadline 6, because deadline 7 provides then an opportunity for comment on it. So we are then clear, we've heard your story, we've heard the applicant's story, and then finally deadline 8 is the applicant's sort of overarching right of reply across all points adverse to them that have been put in the examination as a whole. And so, you know, I would urge upon you the desirability of bringing out anything that needs to be put in front of us by deadline 6. And if you are in a position where it can be clarified that you are sufficiently progressed in negotiations such that we can report to the Secretary of State that there's been a settlement, then again, realistically, deadline 6 is when we need to know that. There isn't a great deal of value in leaving that to the end of the examination, because it then becomes essentially unreplyable to. Unless there are further matters that you want to put to us, I'll seek a response from the applicant.
Jonathan Bauer, on behalf of the applicant, noting with thanks what Mr. Churchill has said, I don't know whether, Mr. Hillis, you want to say anything in relation to the point that was just raised about the extent of the land over which the easement would be required as per the terms of the negotiation.
Sir, John Hillis for the applicant.
Can we just have a slightly high level on that microphone, please? I'll just ask the sound tech to check that.
Sir, John Hillis for the applicant. The trust land is in the intertidal zone, so the easement width we're seeking through there is wider than the onshore easement width of 30 metres. And what we're seeking to achieve in terms of the negotiations is an option to locate our cable circuits anywhere within the order limits. So that is the option area, and to draw down an easement within that option area when we require it for cable installation purposes. So there are some indicative cable alignments provided as part of the application documents, and we would expect that a process of engineering design will be gone through in order to ascertain the final route for the cables, and that will be informed by offshore and onshore site investigations and influenced by other engineering parameters. But we would seek to keep that easement width as small as we reasonably can, bearing in mind constraints that may be present within the order limits within the intertidal zone.
Now, given that we are in this world where there is, you know, a partially formed objection along the lines of a challenge to the physical extent of the easement, I think it would assist us if, by deadline 5, so that as an action arising out of this hearing, and so that the National Trust can see it and respond to it before they have to put their final in principle submission to us at deadline 6, we could see an update to your specific justification for extent, and furthermore, if you're forming a view that you can better define the easement corridor, that you can narrow it at all, then movement on that, if that's something that assists National Trust to consider their position, that there's something to be said for that happening by deadline 5. Now, clearly, if your view is that is not a well-founded objection on their part and that your easement corridor is fully justified, then again, just please explain that. And it can be very helpful in these terms to explain that with reference to essentially what are now verging on industry standard spatial requirements for cabling operations, and if you're able to set out how your spatial requirement for an easement relates to the techniques that you'll be using for cable installation in a way that provides a clear justification, then again that will assist too. Is that something that can be achieved by deadline 5?
Sir, John Hillis for the applicant. We will provide that for deadline 5.
Thank you very much. So returning then to the sort of overarching position for the applicant, is there anything further that needs to be said on this particular objection?
Jonathan Bauer for the applicant. No, sir, I don't think there is anything necessary to say at this stage.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Bauer. Just Mr. Churchill for the National Trust, are you content that you have had your say?
Yes, thank you, sir. Yeah.
Okay. So unless then there were matters that you wish to raise under any of the other agenda items, sir, you are more than free to leave if it assists you with the rest of your morning. Thank you very much. Moving on then, who will lead of the party for RAMAC?
Isabella Tuffle for RAMAC Holdings Limited, sir. It will be something of a team effort, but I will lead.
Mm. Now, obviously, you know, we can start from the platform that was built at your attendance at the last issue specific at the last compulsory acquisition hearing, CAH1. There's no need to reiterate anything that occurred there, but that was very much focusing on the broader strategic questions around why the alignment is where it is, and so what we would now very much like to do is to give you the opportunity to focus on the specific individual objection of RAMAC itself as an entity that owns the land that it owns. So, off you go.
Isabella Tuffel for the applicant. Thank you, sir. Inevitably, there will be some overlap between our strategic case that we made at the last hearing, but we'll try not to repeat that. Raymac's overarching point is that the applicant has failed to show that its proposed interference with Raymac's land interests is proportionate, and as such that there's a compelling case in the public interest. And the principal reason for that is because of its inadequate assessment of alternatives. Under that broad heading, assessment of alternatives, there are four points that we make. One, why was the energy park rejected? Two, if there was a good reason for rejecting the energy park, why was Raymac's land identified as the most suitable alternative? Three, if there was a valid reason for going to Raymac's land next, why was Work Area 13 selected? And you'll recall, sir, that we explained, even in our pre-application consultation responses, that we would prefer other parcels of our land to be used, and we didn't feel that the extent of land sort had been justified. And you'll recall that the applicant's response to all of our consultation comments was a standard response, which simply said, land ownership are still under consultation with all relevant parties and will be taken forward in the post-consent phase. If there had been a proper appraisal of alternatives and land take requirements, one would expect the applicant to have told us about that at the time in response to our consultation comments. And the fourth point is, if the site area shown in Work Area 13 is the most suitable site, why is the extent of land proposed required? We say that a GIS system has the potential to significantly reduce land take. We note that the NEMO link interconnector on the NG Park uses a GIS system. And if a smaller area would suffice, we wonder whether it would be possible to accommodate that smaller site area either on the energy park or on another part of Raymac's landholding. Work Area 13, I believe, comprises 11.6 acres of land. By our calculation, the total site area for the AIS substation is around 8.5 acres. And using a GIS system, we say that could be reduced to 2.3 acres. Now, we note that following the last hearing...
Now I want to just briefly interject there, because where we left that at the last hearing was that the applicant's in-principle position, which they've subsequently documented to us, is that they challenge that. They take the view that for a range of special reasons, that broadly AIS or GIS will call for roughly plus or minus the same amount of land. However, I think I should put the applicant on notice that having read that position, I am still none the wiser as to the precise technical justification for the conclusion that has been reached. And if we, and because in general terms, the proposition that you put forward is a well-known one in the industry, I do have a feeling that we need a deeper technical justification if the applicant is to sustain the point that the two land takes are essentially the same.
Isabella Tafour for Raymac. Thank you, sir. Yes, we note that following the last hearing, the applicant has produced the Appendix 6, which responds to a number of the points that we made at that hearing. Our position in summary is that response to us appears to us to be preliminary in nature. And we say an exercise in retrofitting, so justifying the site and the extent of the land sought after the event, rather than the correct way round, which would be to reduce the land take area at an earlier stage, seek to acquire only the minimum that could reasonably be required, and then see whether that could be accommodated in such a way as to have less interference with Raymac's operations. We note and are grateful for the questions that you've posed to the applicant in your second written questions, which focus on a number of the points we made, including the GIS AIS point. we have a preliminary response to the points that have been made by the applicant in Appendix 6, which Mr. Thorogood will be able to talk you through sitting on my left, including the land take requirements comparatively between AIS and GIS. But as I said a moment ago, and endorsing what you said also, so we find that the Appendix 6 documentation not to satisfactorily address the points we made, either about alternatives off Raymax land or alternative sites within Raymax land holding or the extent of the land required. So if I might just pass over to Mr. Thorogood. Firstly, sir, I'll ask him just to outline his technical expertise, and of course we'll put that in writing in our written summary of our oral representations, but I'll just ask him to tell you orally now so you know who he is and
what
his expertise is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert Thorogood for Raymax Holdings. So I work for Hurley Palmer Flat. I've been with them for 15 years. I had all their technical development and so forth within the company. I'm a chartered engineer. I have a degree in electrical and electronic engineering. And I've been a consulting engineer since 1985. But prior to that, I worked for Hawker Siddeley and was involved in the development of machines, electrical machines, transformers, switchgear, both AIS and GIS, and other forms of switchgear, right from very low voltage up to 150 kV. This is obviously we're dealing with up to 400. But I have also been involved with a number of DNOs, distribution network operators in the UK, in bringing in large power supplies, and also abroad in Ireland, in Sweden and France, including dealing with a utility, Vattenfall. So I think from that sort of experience, I hope I can bring something to the table today. So as has been discussed briefly earlier, I wanted to talk about the substation area that's been defined. So on the basis that it's AIS, there's an area of 215 metres by 160 being identified by the applicant. The area and the arrangement is very well understood. It's fairly conventional for an open compound. The suggestion that we go to a GIS means not only that the components for switchgear, and I should reinforce it, is we're only talking about the switchgear itself, but what it also means is that the arrangements for connections, circuits and so forth greatly reduce in terms of area, in terms of distances between different elements of switchgear, of circuits. This has been used in many locations, particularly in city areas, particularly in London. One example is the Olympic Park. There is a large GIS station there. What it affords is the ability to not only reduce the area, but instead of just keeping it on one level, to actually have a multiple level building in which the components can be then located. So what you've been identified is that we think it's an approximate number. It's in the first assessment that the area could be reduced from 8.5 acres down to 2.3 on the basis that it would be a building rather than an open compound. And this affords a lot of ability to bring these components together, to interconnect them in a different way. But it is a totally different approach. But it's not an unconventional approach because it's going on now in many different locations, particularly around cities. And that's been a need because space is limited and one needs to be able to find solutions to deal with that. There are other benefits with using GIS. There's much less magnetic and electrical interference. There's lower noise. There's better maintenance. The maintenance costs are lower. And there are many DNOs in the country who are going to GIS for almost automatically because of those reasons. So what we would like to have is an assessment to identify what the benefits would be, to show that there is a benefit and how it would look, to simply say that going to a GIS would mean that the area benefit will be eroded, I think, is erroneous. It's not as simple as that, and it needs to be looked at in far more detail.
Thank you very much.
So the other, Isabella Tuffle for RAMAC, the other point that's covered in Appendix 6 are the applicant's reasons for rejecting a number of the alternative sites within the RAMAC's landholding. And one sees that from page 6 of their Appendix 6 report. Again, so I note you've asked a number of questions of the applicant on these points, which we're grateful for. It seems to us as a broad point that the reasons for rejecting other sites within RAMAC's holding appear to be very preliminary and uninformed by any actual assessment. So, for example, in respect of Zone 2, potential for bat roosts. Well, has there actually been any assessment of whether there are bat roosts or whether any steps could be taken to mitigate any impact on bats? Equally, Zone 3...
if we could just scroll down, that would be fantastic.
Thank you. Sorry, page 7. The proximity to a noise-sensitive receptor may result in long-term significant effects. Well, has there actually been any assessment of the potential noise impacts which has informed and led to the rejection of that site?
And furthermore, again, in that context, looking at a sort of moderately complex interplay between residential and non-residential uses, again, the question about whether a noise assessment has been taken with a kind of primary assumption that AIS will be used or GIS, because, again... If a worst case noise assessment is, as I suspect, an AIS test, then that needs to be made explicit in the rationale. But then further consideration clearly needs then to be given to the question of why it is that in a location with noise sensitive receptors, AIS is still the preferred technology.
Yes, sir. Yes. And that theme runs throughout this document, we say, and indeed all of the applicants' documents. We looked last time, and I don't propose to go back over them, but at the statement of reasons and the examination of alternatives in the ES, and there is no explanation of any assessment that's been undertaken to inform the selection of this particular site. We see in respect of Zone 3 there in that table before us on point 3, the suggestion that the length of the export cables would increase and that would increase cost. Well, it may be that I've missed it, sir, but I've seen no assessment in the funding statement of total project costs or any assessment of the costs implications of extending the cable route. So it may be true that there would be an increase in cost to the applicant, but there's going to be an interference with the fundamental right of RAMAC and a minimal increase in cost to the applicant that doesn't threaten the viability of the project in any way, you may think is a reasonable balance to strike so that RAMAC's land, interference with RAMAC's land interests is minimised. So there are these suggestions that there are potential obstacles to alternative sites, but none of them are made good through any actual assessment.
Mr. Faure, I'm also then at this juncture going to place orally another question before the applicant that relates to this complex of issues, which essentially is this, that the applicant is already, and this is a point that we tried to draw out in EXQ2, not necessarily clearly explaining to us precisely why the existing proposed cable corridor is not the most direct in this location, because there is, at least on its face, the proposition that an almost straight line strike could have been taken across the highway and into the Richborough Energy Park. Now, that would, of course, be dependent on other things being possible, such as, for example, the location of a substation, for example, in the Zone 1 land. Now, what we're not asking you to do is to develop a proposal and change the application to relocate that at this juncture, very much the reverse. But what we are asking you to do, if you seek to sustain that which is currently before us, is to give a much clearer explanation as to why the existing route corridor for the cable installation is what it is, because to the extent that you are proposing to rebut the Raymac case on the basis that there would be additional costs and less convenient or longer routes, you've already got a route that isn't the most obvious and is apparently, at least in one respect, significantly longer than it need be. And so we need to understand the balance. We need to understand why the currently proposed route is as it is. And we need also to understand why, in public interest terms, that is a justified route, given the impacts that it has on this particular stakeholder, and why that impact would be less than what might be the pursuit of an apparently more obvious or direct stroke straight line route.
Isabella Tefor for the applicant. Yes, sir, I'm grateful for that. That's the explanation that we're seeking as well. So I don't know if you're anticipating, in response to your written questions, further elaboration of the assessments that have gone into the rejection of the various sites.
Yes, we are.
Thank you, sir. Just on the zones 1, 2 and 3, as I say, without going through them each, we don't accept that these findings are sufficient to justify a rejection of those sites. We would expect to see a lot more analysis of cost implications, environmental impacts, not simply to say, well, it's close to a European designated site or a SSSI. That's true of the work number 13 area as well. And so we would expect the selection of work area 13 to have been formed by a detailed analysis of the comparative impacts of the various sites and costs to the applicant, if that's a factor which has led them to select one site over another in the context of the entire project cost. And we're hoping, as you are, that that further elaboration will be forthcoming at the next deadline at the end of this month, and we'll then be able to respond substantively to those points, because we don't feel that there's much merit other than saying what has been provided is inadequate to going through each of the points that have been provided in Appendix 6.
Which, of course, raises an important point of process, which is that absolutely that does have to come forward at the indicated deadline to enable the bounce down to occur, to enable the rights of those who need to respond in order to be adequately heard, albeit that that is through a written process, because in the national infrastructure world, Parliament has created a system that is both in writing as well as oral. But yes, to enable RAMAC to be adequately heard, then clearly the explanations that emerge in response to both this hearing and in relation to the matters raised in our written questions need to be sufficiently clear and cogent to enable you to fully respond to them, which in turn then enables us to adjudicate any final outstanding point of dispute.
Isabella Tefor for RAMAC. Yes, sir. Obviously, the exemplar position would have been for this information to have been provided at an earlier stage so that we could make the most of these compulsory acquisition hearings to set our case in response. We understand that the scope for that has now evaporated, but we would at least like the opportunity to respond in writing and just put down a marker that we would also like the applicant to justify at the next deadline submissions why a 1 kilometre search area was selected once the Richborough Energy Park was rejected as an alternative. I think Mr. Thorogood's experience that he can speak to is that 2 kilometres or even potentially more than that would have been an appropriate and standard approach to selecting alternatives. And just again to reiterate that we don't believe there is any technical constraint to relocating the substation to the southern part of Raymac's land holding. You've mentioned the Bay Point, and that is an alternative that would be preferred by Raymac to work Area 13, but also the area to the south would again be preferable to Raymac, as we've made clear throughout, even before the application was submitted.
If you wish to bring forward more points relying on your experts' understanding of appropriate process in search and site selection, it would probably be useful to get those onto the table now rather than later so that they can be adequately responded to.
I've been asked to comment on the 1 kilometre search area. There are comments within Appendix 6 as to why 1 kilometre is used, but actually, when you read the explanation, it's quite vague. It's certainly, I would have expected a much wider area of use, certainly 2 kilometres, maybe a little bit more. It does depend often on exactly how the land lies in various, what land holdings there are available, but 2 kilometres wouldn't be unusual. So 1 kilometre to our view seems very restrictive, and we would expect it something more, or at least even if it's to say we've done an initial study at 2 kilometres and there are various reasons why we wouldn't go to that, technical reasons why we wouldn't go to that, and then bring it down. But at the moment it's just set at 1 kilometre, and that seems very restrictive. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Isabella Tafour for the applicants. At this stage, I don't think there's anything further that we can usefully add, other than to say that we look forward to the opportunity to respond in writing following the next deadline. Mm. Our position remains a smaller site area could be achieved with GIS design, which could be accommodated both on the land to the south or on the Bay Point area, or potentially indeed on the Richborough Energy Park.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I have got a number of other questions on the kind of complex of zones 1 through 3 that I do want to raise with the applicant. So before asking the applicant for a response, I think it would probably be sensible if we pass through that material as well, and then the applicant in turn can wrap up the entirety. I'm also conscious that we have cross line here, and probably before I start to ask those overarching questions of the applicant, there would be some value, a lot of value, in enabling Crossline's interest also to be set out because of the possible matters of interface. So, Ms. Gemke-Scuffins, are you ready to speak for Crossline?
Yes, I am. Magdalena Gempka-Scuffins from Crossline Limited. I would like to introduce our company a little bit, so you may have a little bit more understanding on what we do and why we do it. Crossline Limited has been established in 2012, and since then has been leasing land and buildings in Port Richborough, which is now subject of those hearings. Crossline Limited provides 2 main types of services. The first one is that we collect, store and load cars that we collect from Copart Auction that's located right opposite our site. And the other is that we have also a lorry car park. We have explored and researched possibilities of running our business elsewhere. And this land is the only one where our business can work. This reason is the proximity to Sandwich Auction, also land quality and access to that land. But the main and the key feature is the proximity to corporate auction. Crossline Limited is constantly looking for ways of improvement and expansion, and we have plans of growing the business for more than the next 20 years. We have plans of investing in the business in order to create more profit, more jobs, more income. We currently have a five-year lease agreement with our landlord, Raymac Holdings, which was signed in September 2018. However, we have been leasing this land since 2012, and we have never had any indication that our lease would not be extended after this, the current one elapses. Hence why our plans to carry on with the business for more than 20 years. Since we found out about Vattenfall, the applicant's plans, we had to put all our plans and our growth on hold because we have no certainty in what's going to happen with us. We are not able to relocate to any other land. As I've said before, we've explored all possibilities, and this is the only place where we can actually run our business. Therefore, in case of if the land is acquired, we would have to close the business, which would equal to loss of jobs, loss of profit, and loss of everything we've invested. So our view is that we would strongly object to simply being evicted from the land, as it would have a detrimental effect on the business and the people that are involved with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you have any particular observations that you, through me, wish to make on any of the material that's been put before us directly by Raymac? Or, I mean, do you broadly support their position, or are there matters that you want to kind of reserve or qualify in any way?
I have nothing further to add, but we do support Raymac's position.
Okay. Thank you very much. And in relation to that, Raymac, if I can just ask, your understanding of the Crossline position is as they state, or is there anything that you need to tell me that differs from anything that they have said?
Isabella Tafour for the applicant. I think that we agree with everything that they said, and there's nothing further to add.
Okay. Thank you very much. In which case, what I'm now going to do is, could the applicant please put up onto the screens the onshore land plans sheet 2 in the latest version. Yes, I think it's D2. If you're following our document system, it's REP2011, I believe. Okay, and then if we can scroll down to sheet 2, and then if we could just zoom in a little so that we have essentially the Raymac Holdings and particularly the southern site, the Zone 3 site, which includes the Border Force compound and the Crossline land. And we didn't articulate this in the EXQ2 because we very clearly were trying to retain into EXQ2 distinct and easily respondable to single propositions and questions. However, reviewing this group of parcels of land, everything in the pink at that point, I think it's fair to say that we remain unclear as to the precise justification for proposed permanent acquisition of this extent of land. You know, we understand what you want to do with it, and you understand what you need to do in terms of also resolving the Border Force compound position. But beyond that, that's quite a large amount of land. And again, either here or alternatively at the latest at deadline 5, we would like to receive a considered justification for the full extent of that land take that deals with a concern that at the moment we cannot exclude, which is that there is a possible over-acquisition here, that more land is being sought permanently than there is necessarily a clear case for. And the challenge to you there is why it is being sought permanently as distinctly from a circumstance where possibly there may be other means of addressing the objectives sought by the applicant, if those objectives are the construction of a substation, the receipt of a cable alignment into it, the passage of a cable alignment out of it, and also essentially a realignment of the remaining uses on site so that particularly the border force compound issues are dealt with properly and adequately. Now, I guess at the moment our understanding is that those are the very broad outcomes that you're seeking on that land. And at the moment, as I say, we still remain not sufficiently clear from the document set that we have before us that you need all of that land permanently in order to achieve those objectives. And so yes, what we would very much welcome you setting out a detailed rationale there. Now, having placed that onto the table, what I think it would probably be quite sensible to do now, given that we have heard both RAMAC and Crossline, is that if we now take a 20-minute break, we can then return immediately after the break, and then we can hear the applicant on this point. That also gives you a little bit of thinking time to process the interplay of some detail in the RAMAC submissions, and also gives you an opportunity to hopefully make reasonably well-considered responses to that final question that I've just put. So shall we break now? It is 10:58. If we resume at 11:20, and then we will march through the applicant's response. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.